My name's Tom Morris. I'm an associate professor, University of Connecticut, and I'm going to have to speak for Stephen Light because he unexpectedly had to cancel. So the talk I'm going to give today is on a little bit on the history of adaptive management and how we might use adaptive management in agriculture. The term adaptive management has been used for quite a while. And for me, why do we need to learn about it? That's going to be a major part of what I talk about. And it's a process to better manage our natural resources is the way it's traditionally been used. And it's not commonly used in agriculture. Agricultural projects are actually few. Most of the projects have been used, adaptive management used on has been very large natural resource projects in salmon runs, the Northwest Forest for spotted owl. One agricultural project was the Everglades project to try to reduce the phosphorus that gets into the lake down there. So what is adaptive management? The two common quotes that you see are the process of dealing with uncertainty in the management of renewable natural resources. That's from Walter's publication. He's one of the main proponents of adaptive management. And then the process of treating human interventions in natural systems as experimental probes, which is a major idea which has been added to adaptive management from your normal planning process, that you need to do some type of assessment, some type of experiment, and ask some question, collect some data, and get some feedback, and then move on. And the traditional process is viewed here, the traditional plan here that you have. You take the plan, you implement it, you do some evaluation, and then you adjust. What's missing from this, I actually don't like this diagram too much, because what's missing from this really is one of the more important processes requires the active participation of stakeholders. And stakeholders is traditionally used as citizens in adaptive management process. You're usually some big large agency like the Forest Service who is trying to include citizens as stakeholders for making decisions. In our case, in agriculture, the stakeholders really are what I would call the end users more. And that would be the farmers who are making the decisions on the land. The agency people are not making the decisions on the land when you do adaptive management in agriculture. So here's a summary of my talk. I'm going to give a brief history of adaptive management. It'll be primarily in the resource management area. And then the assumptions that are built into adaptive management and how they might help us in agriculture. And then I have some suggestions on how we might implement it in agriculture. Based on some projects that I've been involved in. So what's the history of this concept? It was started in the 1970s by two ecologists, C.S. Holling and C.J. Walters. They are from the University of British Columbia. They were ecologists and management professors. They went on and further developed that at the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna, Austria. And they put out a good number of publications there, as you can find some on the web. Then Kai Lee from Williams College in Massachusetts, who's one of the more interesting authors that I found on this topic. He actually trained as a physicist at MIT, and yet he's working in the sociology department at Williams College. He's now in California. He left the Williams College. And he extended those ideas to include more the social aspect, which is really the most important part of adaptive management and where the results really come from. Improved planning process is one thing, but you really need to implement and get some type of feedback to know how your plan went. And that's what he really emphasized in his writings. And this adaptive management has been used mostly in U.S., Canada, and Austria for management of fisheries, forests, and waterfowl on very large landscapes, and primarily implemented by large agencies such as U.S. Forest Service, U.S. EPA. Holling's innovation, originally called this adaptive environmental assessment and management. It was not just called environmental management. And what he was really after was this number one here, which we don't have to worry about as much now. He wanted to bridge the abyss separating technical impact assessment studies. Back in the early 70s, when we first started with the environmental laws, we were doing environmental impact assessments. And those assessments were oftentimes done by one large engineering firm. And then someone else implemented that five-year plan that they would typically develop. And they were separate. The planning and the implementation was separate, and the people implementing it had to follow that plan, and it was a rigid plan. They didn't have the opportunity to adapt that plan. And he said that's not a good idea, and it's quite obvious it isn't. We don't do that as much today. But the other thing he included in the adaptive management, and that's what we're looking at more today, is discover how to present methods, present methods provide useful prediction of impacts. So his idea was you needed to collect data to find out and predict what your management was going to affect the system. Walters extended the ideas of Hollings to treat management as an adaptive learning process. He brought in the concept of adult learning and adaptive learning and participatory learning. And he viewed those as primary tools for the experimentation. Walters really emphasized you needed experimentation. And you need to more clearly represent the uncertainty in the plans, which was oftentimes not in the impact plans that were built in the 70s and 80s. So the design balanced policies that provide continuing resource production, simultaneously probing for better understanding and untested opportunity. This is a typical language that's used in this literature for the natural resource management. It doesn't really fit our agricultural concepts as well. Lee's idea, he's my favorite author on this topic. He's adaptive management's approach to natural resource policy that states policies are experiments, so you ought to learn from them. And that's whether you plan those policies to be experiments or not. He makes a really strong case for that. So, and he says learning is intensive, very learning, information intensive, requires active participation by those people who are going to be affected by those policies that are being developed. So, and I think the best statement that he has in his literature is increased understanding brings risk of inconvenient disclosure. This concept actually has been cited as what ruins many adaptive management programs. And the idea is that you're going to collect data and you don't know for sure what the answer is going to be. And the answer sometimes in our case, for an example, would be that the scientist's recommendations for a particular practice may not be very accurate. And so then you may have the scientist pull out of that adaptive management project. Or if you're working with farmers and the farmers receive information from that experimentation that you've built into the project, they receive information telling them that their practices are not environmentally sound or not in some way sound, then those farmers may pull out of the process. And in the book that Kai Lee published, he goes into and details some of the projects that have failed exactly for this reason. And you need to be able to manage that and discuss it up front. And Vorlaug's Green Revolution is actually probably the best example in agriculture of adaptive management, although it was never called that. And the adaptive management was through the farming systems research. I was lucky enough to be involved in a farming systems research project back in the late 1970s in Nepal. And I was what's known as a site coordinator. So I lived in a village, and we did experiments in a village, and it was a subsistence-level village. The Green Revolution varieties were not moving into the subsistence-level villages. They were only being adopted by farmers in areas such as the Punjab, where they had all the infrastructure, they had the education, they had the tractors. But that's not really where the Green Revolution varieties were most needed. They were needed in the subsistence-level villages of Asia and Africa. So the idea was that you go to the village and you essentially ask the farmers, what is wrong with these varieties? And you design very simple experiments to look at the questions the farmers had about those varieties. And this Green Revolution obviously was very successful. And it was all based on adaptive management concepts and adult learning. When I worked as a site coordinator in the village, we would do almost the same thing that I'm doing in the Chesapeake Bay project that I work with Environmental Defense right now. We would have simple experiments. We would take the data, collect the data. Simple experiments would be designed with the farmers. We would collect data with the farmers oftentimes, and then we would discuss that data in the wintertime. And then we'd then make a new plan on how we would evaluate in the following year. And the scientists from Summit and Erie who were involved in those projects, they would then take the data from all these sites, and I was just one of about 20 sites that were established in the late 1970s, funded through AID. And they took that information and used it to redesign the varieties. One of the main pieces of information came back, didn't have anything about the agronomy. It wasn't an agronomic problem, it was a social problem. The farmers essentially did not want to eat the rice. It didn't taste good. So they needed to breed varieties that tasted good. That was one major piece of information that came out of that project. The other major piece of information that came out of that project was they needed varieties that had a stable yield. The breeders were always talking about the yield would be five times the indigenous varieties. The farmer said, I don't care if it's five times the indigenous varieties. What I want is maybe three times the indigenous varieties, but never to go less than 1 ton per acre or per hectare. Because the new varieties were fragile. And in a bad year, they get nothing. They would yield nothing. And the farmers knew that. They would not plant it. It was too risky for a subsistence level farmer to go without food for a year because they were always right on the margin. So that's the kind of information that you obtain from an adaptive management program. It typically isn't as much agronomic as it is the social and other areas. And definitions of adaptive management from the natural resources literature, these are the traditional ones that are used. I do have highlighted Stephen Light, the man whose talk I'm replacing. He was one of the originators of adaptive management. He's still a practitioner. And this is an inductive approach relying on comparative studies that blend ecological theories and observations with the design of plant interventions in nature with the understanding of human response. So what you're getting at here is the idea of having experimentation, the idea of having a deliberate plan and some type of reflection. And then you can see the other one here is more of a by the Northwest Oregon State Forest plan. That's more of a I see that more as a bureaucratic definition. They do have the words such as learning from experience, making appropriate change to policy and management practice. This is more of a natural resource bureaucracy that's trying to implement adaptive management from the top down, the way I view it. Now, the draft definition that Jorge put up on the board, this definition is the one that we're currently working with in our adaptive management multi-state coordinating committee. This was developed by a group of scientists primarily from the Northeast when we met down in Washington, D.C. in August of 08. And for now, we're going to keep it as a draft. I like it. It's an ongoing process developing improved management practice for efficient production. So we're looking for efficient production and resource conservation by use of participatory learning is the term that we agreed upon. So through continuous systematic assessment, you're going to have to continually assess because usually you're going to be in a complex situation where you need constant feedback. So, and we did then put a second sentence in the definition about who the participants were. And you can see we've included most people who would be involved in agriculture. And not just the agriculturists, but I believe we also need to have the policy people involved so that this information can then be used in policy. And that's why we are working closely with Environmental Defense Fund for one of the reasons. Now, there's assumptions that are built into these concepts. And the assumptions are, I think, quite interesting, is knowledge will never be adequate. I think all these little excerpts I pulled out of the literature are all quite different from what you would see in a typical engineering-type regulatory environment. They don't match our current definition of how you regulate non-point pollution. Many questions can only be answered by experience and experiment. In other words, we don't have all the answers. Analysis are always going to have to be simplified in a complicated world in order to make some type of policy. And nothing is certain in a very complex world. And I think the best one is the last one. Much of what we know is wrong, we just don't know it. So those are the assumptions built in to this process. And I think we need to have more of this mentality built into our guidelines for all types of recommendations. Why need adaptive management? Well, our food is produced in a complex biological and human systems. So we're always going to have a difficulty making a good prediction. And a decision how to produce food is done by the individuals, farmers on the landscape. So it's very hard to make a blanket regulation across the landscape to have some type of decision made. And practices are recommended, though, by scientists, like myself. These are typically extension people, developed and recommended by scientists. And this process provides us the farmers and the scientists to cooperate closely and environmentalist policymakers and others to make the better decisions I think we need to make about land and resource use. And how is it different from the current processes? I get this question a lot. What's so different? We've been doing adaptive management forever. And that's a typical response I get from people who I've been out talking to about this concept. And I believe it's explicit process of attaining assessments of recommended practices is one of the big things. In other words, we're not just planning. We're deliberately going out and assessing the practices that we recommend and then we're changing those practices. And we also build into an explicit process for learning so that the information is then able to be quickly integrated into the farmers' practices, and then they can use it quickly. Because they have built into the system, they have already believe in the system by joining and having the data collected from their farms. Now, the limitations, I think this is actually, if you want to read one paper on adaptive management, I would highly recommend this one that's cited down the bottom by Gregory et al., professor of management, University of Michigan. And he actually details very clearly the limitations of this method of gathering information and making change in human societies. And the limitations are also in many other papers that you can see in the literature. There's many complaints. And actually, if you go to the literature and do a close search, you'll find that most adaptive management programs were failures. A large majority of them were, for many, many reasons. And this paper goes through why and pinpoints where you can use adaptive management, what type of systems. So you have a spatial scale problem, you have a time problem, an uncertainty problem. If you have too much, obviously you can't get good measures. Costs and benefits, how much is it going to cost to gather the information, what's the benefit going to be, and then you have the user support, institutional user support to try to keep all the people together. And I've separated these out in the paper. They have a number of examples for each one of them. I pulled out just so you get an idea of the type of reasons why projects have failed in the natural resource area. And you have spatial scale complexity. He cited a project, and these people were consultants, so this group of scientists were brought in. And one of their primary functions is, in their consulting world, is to go in and evaluate projects. And they had evaluated many, many adaptive management projects, usually halfway through or sometimes after they were completed. And that's essentially what this paper is about. And there's a climate change and land use type of project, where they wanted to pinpoint what the land use changes we should make over a very large land area. And which parcels of land to protect for biodiversity were one of the questions that they had in this project. But if you protect an area, no replication and no data for decisions. So that's a problem. You don't have any data. You don't have any way to make a decision on that question. So the spatial scale and complexity is too much. And time, too long for data collection, limits effectiveness. This is another big problem in natural resources, where you have to collect data over many years. And the salmon restoration project on a hydro dam up in the Northwest, the treatment there, and you have to have some type of treatment for adaptive management, you're going to be collecting some type of data. Treatment is to change the water flow in the river. But in order to get decent data, they claim they needed to do 3 or 4 different water flows for 3 or 4 different years. So now you have 9 to 16 years before you have enough data to make a decision. And by then, of course, your adaptive management group, the institutional buy-in, the buy-in by the stakeholders is disappeared. And limitations on uncertainty. There were many, many examples that they gave on uncertainty. I pulled one out here. Fuel management treatments in a forest to reduce wildfires. It's another type of idea that looks like it would be good for adaptive management. And the problem is it's uncertain when the wildfires will occur to test your treatments. So you really don't know when you're going to actually get any data. And the limitations on the costs and benefits. It's a cost to change water flows in river versus the benefits of increased salmon spawning. So that's always an ongoing question. It gets usually just done by the economists, but oftentimes the sociologists and philosophers and other people will weigh in on this, on the question, so it's more than just a dollar decision. And then the institutional stakeholder, end user support. I added the end user, actually. I view end users would be the farmers, would be the ones using this information. They need really strong leadership. This is one of the things that they've cited, very strong leadership to guide discussions, especially if you get inconvenient disclosure. If you don't plan for that ahead of time and have proper leadership, you have a lot of problems. And need to use adult learning concepts and techniques for these complex problems. And not too many people are trained in that. And we traditionally, as scientists, like to give answers. We don't like to ask questions. We traditionally have gotten up in front of a group just like I am now, and if I do this a lot still with farmers, and I give answers. And traditionally, adults don't learn as well on complex problems, and I hope Sandy can address that in her talk. Problems are not ag solvable by adaptive management, this is my list, just a list for discussion. Excess nitrogen applications to crops, we're working on that now. We think that's one type of topic you could solve. Degradation of soil health, I just picked that. I think that's one that probably could be solvable. And you could minimize the degradation of our soil in a project that focused on that. Excess pesticide applications would be something else that you could do easily. I threw this one in here, XSP in livestock areas, because I purposely stayed out of the phosphorus area. Because when I look at it, I see that as something that adaptive management probably cannot address. That's really a bigger society question. We have to decide what we're going to do with our livestock. Are we going to allow them to continue to be concentrated? Or are we going to provide huge subsidies to move that manure somewhere else? So that's not something the adaptive management program, I think, can really solve. So. What do solvable problems have in common? What type of problems that are solvable that would have in common? I believe they're going to have to be non-point type of problems. Point source type of problems are fairly straightforward. You don't have to have the human intervention. You know, it's not as complex biologically. So we have complex biological and social processes happening all the time on agricultural production. We have site-specific factors that have a large effect, example, rainfall. And we need to create solutions which require collaboration among producers and all the others who are interested in agricultural production and having an agricultural production that's stable and environmentally friendly and economic. So these are the type of problems, I think, in general that we could look for in agriculture where we could use adaptive management process. How create solutions? I think these are two ideas here which I really think are the best probably that I've gained by going through this literature. The idea of a legitimate problem and a credible solution. And so this process has to work with the end user, in this case the farmers, in order to develop a legitimate problem. If the farmers don't think it's a problem, if you develop a solution, they're not going to use it. So when you go through the literature, you find this runs throughout all the literature. You need to have a legitimate problem that the people believe in. And then, of course, you need to have a credible solution. But the beauty of this is, if you go through this process, a credible solution is then easily adopted by the end user, such as the farmer, because they already have a belief in it. They've already bought into it. They don't have to have somebody like me stand up in front of them and tell them you should be doing this instead of doing this. And I don't know about you, but I've never liked people when they tell me that. So I think we really need to change to an adaptive management type of process if we're really going to solve some of our complex problems. Nitrogen and phosphorus excess. I really think we are most of the way there to defining these as legitimate problems. I don't think there's any question. So I think we're over the hump on the legitimate problem with these particular excesses in our system. Now we're in the process of defining credible solutions. To be honest with you, 20 years ago or 22 years ago, when I first started in this game called science and universities, I don't really think we had consensus that we had a legitimate problem with nitrogen and phosphorus at that time. So the procedure for implementing in the traditional way, this is the language that comes out of the natural resources. I put this up here just to see the way that they think. I have one for us that I'm suggesting we think about. But they put it in terms of ID key indicators, what you want to learn from the system, what are the elements, what are the relationships, bound the system. They usually have such large ecosystems, they want to put some bound on it. To be honest with you, I've never quite understood what bound the system means, but it's in all the literature for adaptive management. Represent current understanding of the system. I think that's more that you're going to build relationship with somebody so that you both understand what you're talking about. So represent the uncertainties so we know what's uncertain, what we know and what we don't know, which is not always easy to do. And design policies to get a better understanding of those systems. This is the experimentation part, which is really a big change for the way we plan as agencies. Procedures for implementing in agriculture. This is drawn from my experiences with a project down in Chesapeake Bay that Susie Friedman's going to speak about. And you need some type of baseline recommendation. You need some type of baseline to work off of. Because you're going to have to do something. You're going to have something to compare to, so you need a baseline. You're going to have some way to reliably assess that recommendation. In our case, we're using a corn stalk nitrate test to decide at the end of the season how well we guessed at the nitrogen. So you need some way to have some feedback, some way to reliably assess. capability to summarize and present results of assessments to farmers in time. So if you collect a large data set, you have to be able to turn it around quick to get it back to them so you can have discussions about it, which I find isn't always easy in a university setting, given all the roadblocks. You need a network of farmers to establish, and you need the right people in that network so that you can all have a good discussion and come up with legitimate problems and credible solutions. And yeah, I believe you need the environmentalists, regulators, policymakers willing to allow changes based on the data you collect. So, changes needed in ag to implement adaptive management. I think we need to start working more with non-traditional partners in agriculture. I really think we need to reach out more to the environmental and regulatory community. I don't think we should be scared of them. I don't really care what Farm Bureau says. I think that's a dead end. I think we're all in this society together, and I think there are solutions that we can work out together that are much better than we work out separately as scientists. So I think we need to change how we educate, mostly from a lecture format to more of a participatory discussion format. And that's very clear that adults learn much better about complex problems if we do that. Reduce turnaround time for analysis of large data sets. There's a certain infrastructure you need to be able to do this. We need to build a little different infrastructure to get the information out quickly. And we need some type of independent third party in some cases. You wouldn't need it in all, possibly. But if you're going to be collecting data that's sensitive in the sense of has regulatory implications, you need some third party to be able to handle that data and to keep it confidential. So in references I have shown, I thought it would be useful for people if you wanted to go look at the literature. I've added a list of references. So that's the end of my talk. I'd be glad to have discussion and questions if you want to.
Question for Tom, okay?
Yes.
One question. I did notice that when we talk about adaptive management, trying to come up with changes as we have changes in agriculture. Well, I did notice the list you had used the word excess.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I agree, sir. And actually, I debated on whether I'd keep that term excess in there. I actually deleted it once and then put it back in. And I think what you're getting at is that's more of a negative.
Right. If you think of excess, you think of reduction. And
yeah.
Not an error necessarily. Reduction is just better utilization.
I agree. You could reframe that to say that the optimization is needed in our nutrients rather than saying excess. But I don't think then on the other side is, and partly the reason I left it in there was, I don't think there's any question we have huge excesses going down on land. And so I decided to leave it in there from that standpoint. Yeah, because I prefer talking up front what the problems are. And the problem is, in some of our livestock areas, we have excess. And that is a problem. The problem, I think, also you could be restated to what you're doing is to say, let's optimize the use of our nutrients. Yeah, which would probably, which I think I may change to, because it puts it more positive. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I noticed you said Ford's research, you like to get it done in a few years. A lot of the systems in natural resources, you can't measure it in a few years. I think a lot of the research take a system and take a component out of it and use that as the indicator. I just want to know how you plan to do. I see you come up with numbers like possibly you can get a trigger number, but what was for the ecology? Was it good or was it bad?
Yeah, you're correct, sir. That the natural resource projects you oftentimes traditionally have taken number of years, and that's been cited as one of the reasons adaptive management has failed. It's hard to keep that coalition together for a long period of time to get a result from an ecological system. But I think what I'm saying is, that in agriculture, we get feedback typically every year. So we can go out and do an experiment, we get feedback within a year. And so that makes this system, adaptive management process, a much better process actually for agriculture than it does for many natural resource concerns, which oftentimes are much greater land areas are much more complex biological systems than what a farm field is. If you think about our biological system as a farm field, now I think you're bringing up the other question would be the ecology beyond just that farm field possibly. And that question we're not addressing as well. That's always been a perennial problem. I view that as a perennial problem in where you make the measurement. Is it going to be at the edge of the root zone for nitrogen, for example? The edge of the field and bottom of the root zone? Because that's the only thing we can reliably measure, that you can reliably measure in the sense of doing it across many, many different locations. You can reliably measure it, but then you're limited to one or two or three or four or five locations. And then you're back into the situation that we're oftentimes in with small plot research that has much information collected from that small plot research, but you then end up with a piece of information that I view as the old story about the blind person feeling an elephant for the first time. You really don't know what the heck you got in relation to all the other situations, conditions, fields that are out there. Yeah. So we're limiting our measurements right now to trying to get the amount of nitrogen into the corn plant that it needs without losing very much. Yeah. And we're not concentrating on the ecological question, the bigger ecological question, how that improves the ecology. Yeah. Yeah, having environmental agencies buy into it. I guess you'd have to split that up into regulatory agencies or nonprofit environmental groups. I think it's very clear that Environmental Defense is willing to and committed to long-term association with farmers to try to improve the environmental and economic farm situation. Environmental regulators, I have a very close relationship with the State of Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection. I see them on a regular basis. I feel it's part of my job to do that, to keep them informed, and also for me to be informed on what they're thinking. I find that to be more of a political process, much more of a political process than I'd like it to be, and I don't have an answer to keep long-term. The long-term for me on that is developing a relationship with a person that's the important person to make decisions, and as soon as that person retires, you're back to square one and the whole game changes again. So that I don't know the solution to that. Yeah. You just pray they don't retire. But we just had early retirement in Connecticut and due to the financial crisis, so we lost all. I don't hardly know anybody down there anymore. I'm going back and starting over again.
We have time for more discussion and questions, Phil.
Yes, sir.
I'm intrigued by the concept that I'm from industry. I'm also
just because you mentioned all that, I have a couple of questions here for Tom, and I think this is much of yours. So, and one of my questions was, inconvenient disclosure. You had that slide there, which brings to us, I think, inconvenient disclosure. And then you talk about bringing the regulatory agencies. How do you match inconvenient disclosure with what he said and with the regulatory agencies? When that inconvenient disclosure might bring some problems, or I don't know why. I mean, can you talk a little bit more about all of this, Tom?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. The I'd just like to start out with the excess question again. I'm not so sure industry should be concerned with a discussion about excess, because it's a reality. And, I mean, it is an excess. So I guess, do you really think that having a discussion about excess, which is a problem in some areas, is that really something that's going to turn industry off enough that we can't join together? Okay, there's, all right, that's the button. That's what I was looking for, I guess, yeah. Yeah, deliberately doing the excess, I believe that's the true, not true. And that's probably the connotation of the word excess, which is causing the problem.
It was true in the 70s, when nitrogen was 5 cents a pound, more than likely, because we had no tools.
Well, it's still, you can economically justify insurance policy at 5 cents. Nitrogen has an insurance policy at 5 cents a pound nitrogen. Yeah, so. And then the question of inconvenient disclosure.
Regulation.
Yeah, and regulation. That's a tough one that I think is still being worked out. Obviously, when you go to the adaptive management literature, it's very clear that's still being worked out, even where they've been running projects for 15, 20 years. And what I think we probably need to do is what we've done. We keep the data confidential within an independent third party. So the university doesn't have it, and the farmers don't have it. The farmers get their own data, obviously. But the independent third party is an independent consultant type of person that has a server large enough to handle that and control over that information. Yeah.
But I mean, like, okay. I was looking for a little bit more.
But. Yeah, but I'm not sure how else to handle it. The information we collect has to be confidential, or the farmers won't join in for that open discussion. Because when we bring the data, what we do is we bring the data to meetings, data that's been collected, and we're talking about corn stalk nitrate values, that oftentimes will be excessive. It'll be excessive for a number of years, livestock areas. And I think the other point that I want to make about that data set is that usually 15 to 20% of the fields show deficiencies or very low values. So some places we're not putting enough, other areas where we have excess. Yeah.
So the farmer is protected, absolutely.
The
farmer is protected, absolutely.
Yes, the farmer has to be, or they will not cooperate. Yeah, there's it just won't happen. And we primarily go through industry. The whole project we have runs through industry. So it's the agricultural consultants who run the project, essentially. Yeah.
That I am one of those industries, and that model you're describing is non-functional, because what it does, where I want as industry to be thought of as the source, I want to be the third-party aggregator. I don't want to be the person that does all the work and passes my data to your third-party aggregator, who gets the credit, who could come to Washington, D.C. and lobby with that information. What I'm saying to involve agriculture, maybe, look at some of the retail or the industry as being aggregators, the CPFs, the Agriums, those kind of people, possibly being the warehouse and then bringing the data together into one source.
Yeah, I go ahead, Susie. Yeah,
this is getting interesting. So,
I just want to point out the project that we're working with Tom on, that third party who's managing the data is a crop consultant. So it's.
Yeah, and they're never going to take. They're not going to use the data to go anywhere. Yeah, that's why we.
You bring a good point. I hear that one.
But I think you're going to get in the question of validity of the data. If the ag industry has the data, then you're going to have the environmental groups possibly. So you have to build the relationship so that the ag industry would be viewed by the environmental community, regulators and nonprofits, as a place where the data could be secured, it would not be manipulated. I don't have to say much more. You know what could be brought up. Yep.
Another question that I just said, to go back to your production and variability and maximizing, you also talk about uncertainty.
Yep.
Yeah, weather, and then adapting. How do you throw in, so there's so many talk and we kind of agree there's climate change or climate variability of extremes. How do you throw all of that in there maybe you could put 100 pound of nitrogen going back to nitrogen and you could have a really high precipitation and then have some leaching and then you have to come back and even put even more.
Oh.
Because you just leaching it, and it was a wet year, wet season right after. You don't control it.
Well, yeah, that's what.
How do you put all of this together?
That's the question. It's the question of uncertainty that's built into your system. And Jorge is getting at the fact that rainfall is going to be one of those major uncertainties. And I always like to tell a story when I am talking with farmers, and they get frustrated by the fact that I oftentimes will not give them a recommendation because I don't really think my soil test lab, I'm actually director of the soil test lab also, I don't think we should be giving recommendations out anymore because any recommendation I give out for any given field is going to be wrong probably. For nitrogen, because I never have enough information to really know what to recommend for any particular field. So, but what we're building into the system is the ability to handle that uncertainty and have some guidelines on how to handle it, and guidelines that then define how you should handle it and accepted procedures. So if you do get that rainfall, you at least can document that you did what you were supposed to do. Yeah. So.
Yeah, we were in Dearborn, Michigan together. This is the joint symposium, so I knew the answer, but I wanted to. Any other? Do we still have time? Yes.
In the system, some of the things, such as temporal properties, time sensitive, those are the things that create uncertainty. But if you do good planning, that's one of the answers to it. I noticed. It was not stated in there, but planning is a part of a system. Because you have those different kind of, you got heterogeneous soil patterns, you got the timing, you got different management has occurred on a piece of property.
Yep.
It's a lot of things there.
Yeah, and that we try to address as much as that as possible when we obtain field histories. So that is included in our database for our guidelines. So the system we're building includes as much of that uncertainty that we can easily obtain, information about that uncertainty that we can easily obtain.
Okay.